Welcome to Excess Returns, where we focus on what works over the long term in the markets. Join us as we talk about the strategies and tactics that can help you become a better long-term investor.
Justin Carboneau and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.
Hey guys, this is Justin. In this episode of Excess Returns, Jack and I talk index methodology, construction, and the ETF landscape in general with Bloomberg's Athanasios Sarasthagas. There are many small and large differences in how indices are created, and it's important for investors to understand these differences so that they know the possible pluses and minuses of different indices and also the exposures they might be getting. We look under the hood of the major equity indices and also spend time discussing international and fixed income indices too. Thank you very much for listening. Please enjoy this discussion with Bloomberg's Athanasios Sarasthagas. Athanasios, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hey guys, thanks for having me. Very glad to be here.
So this conversation that we're going to have today actually started as an actual internal discussion that Jack and I have had over the years about different ways that indices construct their indexes and the index methodologies. And it sort of came full circle. I don't know, just recently there's been some stuff either in the Wall Street Journal. I think Bloomberg has put out some stuff. It's been a combination of articles talking about different indexes and different exposures that they have as a result of different methodologies that they have, which is what we're going to kind of tackle today. And also sort of this, I've seen recently, you know, some pieces on the continued growth in ETFs and the proliferation of ETFs, and more investors are allocating to ETFs, and how that's kind of changing, has been changing the investment landscape for a while. But so I think that, and, you know, we were talking a little bit beforehand, this discussion with you, which is, you know, you spend your days looking at indexes, looking at ETFs, understanding the subtle and sometimes big differences between a lot of these things. And, you know, clearly investors have trillions of dollars in these products. So the reason that we wanted to have you on, specifically you, is because we think this is an important topic to cover. And it's probably underappreciated and talked about in the industry. Jack and I are looking forward to this with you because, like I said, you spend your days and you spent your career effectively at Bloomberg kind of looking at this kind of stuff. So this is going to be great. Thanks again.
Yeah, this will be great. And I think you nailed it. Like, there's 3,000 plus ETFs in the US now, right? A lot of it's active. Fine, we could talk about that later, but most of it's indexed. And a lot of people just pick an ETF based on the name. But you really have to get into the index differences, right? Every index house is different, the way they even have definitions of different factors or market caps or whatnot. So it's really important to like understand that. I get it. It's not the most exciting stuff. Like, who wants to pour through pages of index methodology documents? But I think it's by far probably one of the more underappreciated aspects of like doing analysis on ETFs.
There are, like you said, thousands of ETFs that investors have to choose from right now. A lot of them are passive. But it seems to me like the lines, and it's probably been this way for a while, like the lines are getting blurred a little bit. I'm just interested in your comments on some of these like passive ETFs actually have a lot of elements of sort of active management sort of embedded in there. What are your thoughts on that? Like, how do you kind of approach this when you have your standard active ETFs, the market cap weighted ones, and then, you know, everything else underneath sort of seems to embed some type of difference, and it kind of, some of them can really lean towards active. So I'm just interested in your thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. And you're right that it's blurry. So we have this category we sort of call like new active, where it's not really active, but it might. So most people, when they look at passive, they'll say, oh, it tracks an index. That's fine. But let's say like the index only has 50 stocks and it rebalances every month, and it based on this screen, like, yeah, that's a lot of rules, right? And somebody had to come up with those rules, and all they did was write it down, systematize it, and build it. Like, is it technically indexed? Sure. But I think, and more so over the last like couple years, it's gotten more profound. Like, here's a mind-boggling stat that I still like think is pretty crazy. A third of the ETF industry is less than 3 years old. So it's still a lot of these new products. Most of the stuff is pretty new. And so that line is definitely blurry. And I think it goes sort of two ways. One, let's call it smart beta, right? Or factor investing, which is really popular. that's $1 trillion in assets. So most of the time we'll just bucket that into passive, like, oh, it's tracking some smart beta index. But really, is it? So I know it's tough to segment it, but I think there is a lot, big chunk of the industry is what we sort of call like quasi-active or sort of passive light, because yes, it's an index. You can recreate the methodology, you can look through it, but the inputs are very, very active light. And this is just a trend that we're seeing, like more of the ETFs now are getting very concentrated. Like no one's building an index as a benchmark anymore. Like it's just, that's not what the index providers are doing. They're building something that could be packaged into a product, probably sort of alpha seeking or whatnot. And that's just where most of the work is being done. So again, this is why it's so great we're doing this podcast, because most of the stuff that's coming out is not quote unquote benchmark type stuff. It's very, very active. Like whether it's purely active with no index or it's like an index methodology that is very involved, that has a lot of inputs built into it.
Yeah, to your point, you know, we used to run an ETF. We ran a small cap value ETF. And as part of that, you know, for a portion of it, we were a passive ETF. And for a portion of it, we were an active ETF. And so when we were a passive ETF, we had an index. But the difference between our strategy was zero. Like we effectively ran the exact same strategy as passive or active. So like just that line doesn't really tell you anything about what the strategy is.
Yeah, exactly. The only difference is like you wrote it down versus doing it. And now it's like when you write it down, it becomes a passive index, right?
Right.
But and I think, you know, so I think there's a lot of the ETFs in there that are I would put into this sort of new active category that it has an index, but it is very, very active-like.
It's interesting that, you know, your point that a third of the ETFs out there are still pretty young. Maybe they haven't even really seen a bear market. Well, maybe if they've been around 3 years, maybe they've seen COVID or maybe not. But, you know, can you just sort of set the stage before we get into some of the nitty gritty details as to some of the growth numbers in passive investing and ETFs? And what does it look like when you're looking at ETFs versus mutual funds? And I know, you know, Eric, your colleague, Balchunas, has, I know I've been to a few conferences where he always shows the chart of like all the big name ETF providers have like I don't know the exact numbers, have like 90% of the assets and everybody else is, you know, fighting for the other 5 or 10%. So just, I don't know, for our audience to get a little bit of the landscape here, can you just share some of the important details that you think are important?
For sure. So let's just say top line number. US ETFs are about $7 trillion, which is really impressive. And if we look at that in the context of other passive funds, it's about 50-50, meaning there's about another $7 trillion in passive mutual funds. Again, this goes back to, we're just assuming all the ETFs are passive, which we'll talk about more. So in the US, this passive trend is probably the strongest of like any region globally. It's about 50-50. Why it's becoming so interesting now, and especially over the last like 2 years, a lot of asset managers are finding ways to come into the ETF market. So there's a big thing that's been, conversions, right? So like DFA was probably the biggest one to do this. They converted about $30 billion or so mutual funds into ETFs. The second thing is there's a special Vanguard patent that's expiring. So they're kind of unique and their ETF is part of their mutual fund. So a lot of issuers are looking to leverage that and tack on an ETF to an already existing mutual fund. And the third way has been asset managers just launching an ETF business. And we track like all the top 20 or 30 asset managers in the US. Pretty much everyone has an ETF business now. So a lot of times, whether it's not necessarily even an active or passive debate, it's just a wrapper. The wrapper is much more efficient. You have a huge tax boost that you get through the ETF that you don't get in other regions. So I think just all equal. Let's say if everything's equal, the strategy equal, you probably would prefer the ETF just because of the gain tax efficiency. But then the other thing is, as you mentioned, I think it's something like 85%, the top three. But the bigger Vanguard gets, the lower fees are becoming, right? The average fees being dragged down. So as they keep growing, as ETFs keep growing, it's forcing all these other asset managers to either lower their cost or move into the ETF market. And that's really the biggest trend of all, it's just cost, right? And you can access all these strategies that we're talking about, that you can access them for pretty cheap in the ETF wrapper. I think you can build a low cost global portfolio for something like 2.5 basis points, which is insane. Like it's probably like the greatest time ever to be an investor. Maybe not so much for the issuers in terms of how much money they're making, but as for what it's done for investing, has been like unbelievable.
Yeah. As we move into the indexes here, we want to start with, you know, the one people follow the most. And we were talking beforehand. It's interesting to me, like I'm a pretty sophisticated investor, but if you were to give me a test right now on exactly how the S&P 500 was constructed, and I hope you don't give me this test, I'm going to fail the test because I know at a high level, like how it works, but I don't know the details. So can you just talk a little bit about, like, in general, how the S&P 500 is built?
Sure. So I think most people would say, oh, it's the 500 biggest stocks in the market, but really it's not. So there is a committee that sort of decides what stocks they want to add into the index. And if anyone's looking for like a perfect example of like a company that was big, but wasn't in the index, was Tesla, right? So I remember like Tesla had run up, it was in like all these other passive indexes, but it wasn't in the S&P 500 when it was the bigger, one of the top 500 companies. So the unique thing that S&P does, it has this profitability screen. So it won't let companies in that don't have a year of profits. And Tesla didn't. And finally, when they turned profitable, they got added into the index. Now, that was probably the most extreme case of a company that's gotten so large that was unprofitable that eventually got added to the index. And there's other some interesting times, like during the financial crisis, that names should have been kicked out, but the committee thought they should still remain in the index. But to your point, it's like even passive, which we think in our minds, like, oh, S&P is the most passive thing out there, is not, right? It's pretty involved. Now, granted, you know, sometimes there's not that many changes to it, but it's important to know that there is a committee that looks at what stocks are going to be added. Now, there are other indexes like the Vanguard Total Market that might be, quote unquote, more purely passive that won't worry about profitability. It's just going to look at market cap. So for an example there, they had Tesla in the whole time before the S&P committee decided to add them. So it's just important to know that there is a committee that decides what will be added into the index.
Do you know, you mentioned the profitability criteria. Do you know like how much of it is quantitative? Like they have rules and how much of it is the committee just decides what they want to do?
Yeah, I mean, the rule is pretty straightforward. It just has to have four trailing quarters of profitability. And that's the thing, is that's how they apply to all their indexes. So it just has to have four straight quarters of profitability. Now, let's say if it starts to fall out of that, sometimes there's a buffer to saying, well, it's just like a one-off, should we still keep it in the index? Or if they continue to lose money, then they'll eventually they'll kick them out and find a replacement.
So they could say, though, in theory, the committee could say, right, they do meet the four quarters of profitability, but I don't want to add Tesla. Like they can make that decision if they choose to.
Oh, for sure. And one of the things, they always sort of put this language in the docs, is they want to make sure that it's most representative of the economy, right? So let's say it's like, you can't have the index be 100% tech, right? So let's say they maybe are at their max of what they want to add for tech companies. Even though there might be eligible candidates, they might add in another sector to make sure that they have sort of broad representation of like the U.S. economy. And it's not just very heavily weighted towards one sector. So they do have that sort of override that they'll say, you know, we want to just make sure that we maintain proper coverage and integrity of the index.
How often is the S&P 500 rebalanced?
Yeah, it's kind of whenever. And this one makes it even tricky. Whenever they decide, most will have a date, right? It's June or September. We're going to reconstitute the index and add the names. The S&P is just whenever. I think they tend to keep it in the same, on the calendar quarters, but it really, you don't know when it's going to decide, only when they decide that they want to make a change to the index. Which again, it's not.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Right?
Like it's all right. But it does probably do a pretty good job. Like if you think about it, as you want to represent the overall stock market. Like I would assume, you know, if you look at like a total market index versus the S&P 500, they probably track each other pretty closely because we're getting all the biggest companies in there.
Yeah, they for sure. If you pick like even the Vanguard Total Market or like some FTSE large cap, they Tesla is probably the biggest difference that we would have seen, but for the most part over the long term, they track pretty well.
Yeah, I remember that whole time around, like when they were adding Tesla, it was very like controversial, like how much, you know, it was running up into it, and you know there was all kinds of debate. I remember around what they were doing and like if they were going to buy it at the high and everything like that.
Yeah, and it was definitely a big deal because normally most of the companies that change are pretty much at the bottom. This would have been like a top 10 holding right away, which I don't know if that's ever happened, right? That is coming in at such a big weight into the index. So it was a pretty unique case for sure.
Before we shift to another index, I just wanted to ask you, you know, one of the things you're hearing right now is that the top companies, you know, represent a massive portion of the S&P 500 right now. And, you know, we have people talking about that, like, being unprecedented levels. And I'm wondering if you just have any context around that, like how much of a percentage they are of the S&P 500 right now versus what they've been at other points in history.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what it is now, but I think that it's pretty high, right? And I think you have to go back really far back to see like the same sort of like concentration. But that's sort of the double-edged sword of market cap weighting, right? Which is like what the S&P and these other, most of these big indexes will be. It's just going to keep holding the biggest names. And a lot of times, over time, that works. But when it comes to a product, right? Like, let's say you want to launch an ETF off the S&P. And this actually happened with the Qs, right? That you run into concentration limits. So there's all these rules, the diversification rules that in ETFs need to have. And it got to the point, and I think this was the second time in history that the Qs had to do this, that the Super 7 was getting to be such a big weight in the index that they had to schedule a special rebalance to take all the weights down. Now, normally it doesn't happen. Like in a perfectly market cap world, that would just keep running. But for sure, the other thing, when it comes to, you know, a lot of the tech ETFs or whatnot, you have to keep in mind a concentration. Like, according to the index rules, anything can't be more than 25% or whatnot. But that's still a lot, right? If you have two companies that are 25 and 20%, that's half of your index in one stock. But I would say for something as broad as the S&P and the amount of assets that track the S&P, it's definitely pretty concentrated to where it's been in the past. But to alleviate that, there's other interesting ideas that are out there that people can pivot to. So let's say you want to buy equal weight S&P. So you can reduce concentration, or a reverse cap weighted S&P. There's all these like interesting ideas for someone who might be looking to diversify away from some of that concentration risk. But it's definitely high. I think in context, has to be one of the highest, if not like ever, for the top names concentrated in such big weights.
Yeah, it was interesting. We had a growth manager on who was talking about his portfolio, and he made an interesting point that I never thought of, which is like he was a big believer in Apple. And his point was like, if I want to have a high conviction position in Apple, I can't really do that because it's such a high weight in the S&P already. Like, I can't really overweight it much more than that. So it's hard to have a high conviction position in Apple relative to like the market cap weighted indexes right now.
No, yeah, that's a great point. I think that's why probably active also underperforms a lot of times, right? And especially in something like this, to your point, they can't buy anymore. Like, Apple will just keep running up and until it hits the upper limit. But an active manager is probably not going to go 25% in Apple, even though an ETF technically could. And so, yeah, that's a really great point that, you know, a lot of these funds can't replicate it because they just can't go that high in a weight.
I don't know if as many people track this as they used to, and you can correct me if I'm wrong about that. But I did want to ask about the Dow because it is sort of an old index that all of us are used to. And can you just talk a little bit about how that's constructed and how it's weighted and things like that?
Sure. Yeah, I think they just started doing it simplicity, but it's just weighted on price. So like the bigger your price handle is, the bigger weight you're going to get. And it sounds a little arbitrary, like, oh, well, that's just like totally random. But over time, it really works. Like it's I think over some periods, it even beats the S&P 500. While it does get a lot of attention on like the media outlets, people are always like quoting the Dow. I will say there's not a whole lot that tracks it. There's one ETF that tracks the Dow Jones Industrial Average, and that's pretty much all the assets that are linked to that index. It's like 70% of the assets are just in that ETF. So it's a pretty cool idea, but outside of the ETF, it doesn't really get a whole lot of assets tracking it. But I think it just seems like gravitating towards large cap equities, U.S. equities, has worked over time. And it's pretty sure that even the Dow or the Qs or whatnot have all seemed to perform really well, regardless of their like leading methodology.
Do you know, is the Dow a committee as well in terms of how they're figuring out the stocks?
Good point. I think it is because it's now under S&P. So I think there is like a committee oversight to it. But those rules are a little bit more clear, that it's just taking like the largest price handles and putting and weighting it based on that.
Yeah. And it's certainly far beyond industrials these days, although it's still called that to some people. Yeah. But it's definitely way beyond that now. I want to shift to the Nasdaq 100, which, to be honest, I'm not exactly sure how that's constructed either. I mean, I would assume we talked about that overweighting issue of certain stocks. I would assume that's probably even a bigger issue in the Nasdaq 100 than it is in the S&P 500. But can you just talk about how that index is built?
Sure. Yeah. So that one's pretty easy. It's just it's the companies that are listed on the Nasdaq. So again, it's so interesting that these are like kind of arbitrary rules. You're like, oh, well, I'm warning and pick companies that are listed on this exchange. But what's so amazing with the NASDAQ has just been its performance over time. And you get a lot of tech companies that just gravitated towards that exchange. So it's just picking the top 100 companies on the NASDAQ X financials. And this was actually a pretty good trade like a couple years ago. Remember when there was the SVB banking issue? So the NASDAQ was actually perfect because it was overweight tech and it had no financial exposure. It was like the perfect trade for that year. To a thing I mentioned earlier, like, yeah, it is very tech heavy. You have more tech than even some of the other, even the S&P. So again, with the tech overweights getting so large this year, they did have a special rebalance, which is a very, very unique thing. This only happened like a couple months ago, that the weights basically put them out of compliance for diversification rules. So they just had to take those back down, which is essentially just like selling the winners and having to buy some of the bottom companies. But if you look at over time, it's been like the best performing. I think TQQ, which is like 3X NASDAQ, is like the best, one of the best performing ETFs of all time. So obviously it's been a strategy that's worked. It's done really well. Most active managers can't beat the S&P 500. I think if you benchmark it to the Qs, it's like almost virtually nobody. It's just been like it's been a really interesting benchmark. And I think it's probably been more indicative of like, again, with the overweights in tech, of just like, you know, the US economy. And they like to tout themselves as we're the better benchmark than the S&P. But it's been something that's worked for a long time. But that one construction, again, just any the top 100 companies listed up in NASDAQ.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You know, one of the misconceptions I think about that with investors is people think it's 100% tech. You know, when you talk to individual investors, they'll be like, oh, that's a technology index. And I think it is. I don't know the exact weight. I'm sure it's incredibly heavily weighted towards tech, but it's not all tech.
No, for sure. It has every sector except for financials. Like, it won't be as much as the S&P or like even the Dow. You'll get way more industrials in the Dow, right, in financials. So again, it's just a market call too. Like, I think last year the Dow was doing really well, right, because you didn't want to own tech last year. But yeah, it's definitely, I think people will just automatically group the Qs with tech. I think Invesco played a role in that too, the way they sort of promote it a little bit. And I think your just mind's automatically going to associate the Qs with tech.
Yeah. So now we get into a little more interesting stuff here as we drill down a little bit. And the small cap indexes are very interesting to me because everybody tends to, you know, in the media, you tend to see the Russell 2000, but there's the other index, the S&P Small Cap 600, and they are very, very different indexes in terms of how they're constructed. And, you know, people like me who are looking behind the scenes will realize you're getting a very different product with those two. So can you just sort of talk about what those two are and the differences?
Sure. So the Russell 2000 is pretty much like, it just, every issuer has a different threshold for caps, right? So just based on the Russell methodology, they're just going to take the bottom 2000 companies and their tiering market cap threshold. The S&P is interesting. Again, so they start with something called like the S&P 1500, which is the total market. You have the 500, which is the large cap, the 400, which is the mid cap, and then the 600, which is like the bottom. But what's interesting about the S&P, and this rolls up all the way up to the S&P 500, is they have that profitability screen too, right? So the small cap companies in that index have to have the four quarters of profits. Well, in the Russell 2000, you don't. I think I saw a stat of something like 75% or so of the companies in the Russell were not profitable. But I think that becomes really interesting difference in small caps, because when you do that screen with the S&P, you sort of have less of a tilt towards growth, right? It's more quality, it's more value because you have all these profitable companies. And I feel like if you want more growth exposure, the Russell 2000 might be a more interesting play, because by getting rid of that profitability screen, you probably have a little bit more exposure to growth names. So the Russell tends to do well when growth outperforms value and vice versa. But just keep in mind, if you are buying the S&P, they're both really big, they both have a lot of assets tracking them, you're going to get a little bit more of a quality tilt in the S&P 600 small cap index.
Yeah, to your point, like fundamental guys like us love the small cap 600 because of the profitability screen, but that can also be a double-edged sword. You know, you get one of these markets where the growth companies, you know, are really running, you're going to struggle with that index probably relative to the Russell 2000. Because to your point, the Russell 2000 has a lot of, 75% surprises me, but yeah, it has a huge amount of unprofitable companies.
Sure. Yeah. And you get a lot of financials in there too. So remember, like during the regional banking crisis, like the Russell was hammered because it was a lot of these like small regional banks tend to be in there. So again, sector biases are really important too in these indexes to keep in mind. But you're going to get a lot of financials, a lot of energy too. And this, and sometimes, like you said, it could rock when that stuff is working. The Russell 2000 is like moving, but it can turn against you really, really quickly. But if you're more, say, you want to focus more on quality, profitability, the S&P 600 might be a better choice.
Yeah, like I would assume, I don't know the stats in front of me, but I would assume the 600 is probably doing better than the Russell 2000 this year. Like the Russell 2000's had a pretty rough year.
Yeah. I think the energy's really kind of dragged it down quite a bit. And, you know, I think quality's done a little bit better, which will give a boost to the S&P 600.
So when we think about value and growth, and this is where we're going to spend a good portion of the discussion, you know, that's something a lot of us in the sort of the fundamental space debate, how these different providers handle value and how they handle growth and how they separate them. And I think there's two major ones, you know, S&P and Russell, who are doing it. And I think they have different ways they go about it. So can you just talk a little bit about how they distinguish value from growth?
Sure. I think, you know, the quants love to argue about this, and you can see it with ETF construction too. So Russell, I mean, they priced the book tends to be the most popular. I think Russell's pretty married to that. A lot of the big Russell value growth or growth indexes are using price to book as the measurement. S&P uses this too, but what I like about some of the newer stuff is they use a composite. You know, some might be using PE, price to book, EBITDA, enterprise value, all these different composites. But I think most people, just investors, understand price to book. It's been there for a very long time. They're kind of married to these indexes. So I think moving away from it has been pretty tough, but price to book is by far the most used one. But as we see more and more of the new products come out, they're using a little bit of a composite, or they might use something sector specific. Like they might not use price to book for financials, and they might shift to something else. But I'd say overall, that's probably the most popular one, because it's I think it's just been around the longest. I think a lot of the academic research has been around the longest for it, so there's a lot of like underpinnings for it.
That's an interesting thing that I think people get wrong, both about the academic research and the indexes, is they think about value and growth, and they think, well, I've got a value criteria, and then I've got a growth criteria. But what it really is cheap versus expensive for the most part.
Yeah.
You know, for the most part, we're assuming, you know, expensive companies are growth. I mean, I don't know if you know this, but I don't think there's too much explicit growth criteria in terms of setting the growth companies.
No, a lot of it's just earnings growth, right? Or one, and sometimes with like, a lot of times if they don't know where to put it, like, oh, if it's not value, it's got to be growth. Or if it's not growth, it's got to be value. And sometimes it's not that simple, right? And I agree. And a lot of times it's just relative too. So, you know, depending what sector you're in, a lot of these indexes might want a sector neutralized. So there could be growth companies that are less growthy within their sector and not getting pulled in. I think the criteria is very, very splattered around all, you know, different index houses like to use different methodologies. You know, some outperform in certain times, some don't. But a lot of times it seems like a composite makes a lot of sense for the long term, because, you know, not only sector timing, but there's factor timing, right? Within factors, like within value, sometimes free cash flow works better than price to book for some years and whatnot. So I think we see sometimes investors moving towards a more composite approach, is just to sort of flatten that out a little bit and not maybe have to deal with some of the factor timings.
And thinking about sort of the blurry line between value and growth, I think a good thing to look at is sort of the Mag 7 stocks, because they've been, you know, if you think about it, in recent years with what's gone on, we've seen some of them, you know, anybody off the top of their head might say, oh, they're all growth companies, but we've seen ones like, I think Meta and some other ones have started to appear in the value indexes instead of the growth indexes.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And the other thing with that, they're in so many ETFs, right? So let's say Apple is in like 400 plus ETFs. Now going down this rabbit hole of methodologies, like it's bound to pop up in different value ETFs. It's bound to pop up in growth ETFs and momentum ETFs and quality ETFs. And that's the thing about some of this being so big, is that you're sort of popping up everywhere, right? And to your point, it become confusing. Like, wait, is this a value stock or is it a growth stock? Or is this an ESG stock or is it not an ESG stock? Because it's in this one, it's not in that one. That one's really interesting. There's some other interesting ETFs like growth at a reasonable price. Like GARP is a pretty interesting one that, oh, it's looking for these growthy names with a value tilt to it. And I don't know if Meta's in there, but this seems like it might be a good candidate for it. But I think the lines of value and growth can get kind of blurry. If you look at the Russell 1000, there's quite a bit of overlap, right? Like the way they do their basic ones is, okay, you have to be in one, but there's a lot that can actually be that can be in both, right? So you have like a third of it that has a lot of overlap between the two. So again, it's important to know the different factor definitions.
So with Russell, you can be in both the growth and the value index. Is that right?
Yeah, you can. And so this is, so I think on average, about a third is in both, which again, it's like, well, is it one or the other? And so again, it comes down to like the way they define it. It's like, oh, well, it has to be in one or the other. But sometimes if the methodology is not clearly in one or the other, they can, meaning they'll still be in both. Like you'll have Apple in the value index and in the growth index. And if you run that overlap, you're like, well, it falls into both because the criteria is not necessarily definitive in one direction or the other.
And with S&P, they'll kind of do it both ways, right? They're like, when you talk about pure value and pure growth, that separates them. And then when you just talk about growth and value, they can overlap. Is that right?
Yeah. So that's like the pure ones, then they don't overlap, right? So the pure ones more like within the S&P family, then like, no, we're only going to pick the value stocks. We're going to pick the growth stocks. So it's sort of like, we like to think of it as like a watered down level, right? So it's like, okay, at the top, let's say the Russell 1000 value is like only a little watered down. Like you get a sprinkle of value, but some of these stocks can be in both. As you get further down to pure value or whatnot, it gets much more concentrated, right? There's fewer names. These ones are much stricter with their criteria. They're probably going to give you much better exposure to the value factor as you can go further and further down. So again, this is one thing there's all these different ETFs. The important thing is like as the investor, like what are you looking for? Like, do you just want something that's a little watered down? Like you want a little sprinkle of value in it? That's fine. Or do you want the hardcore value stuff that you have to go all the way down and like, okay, these ones are meet the most stringent requirements for value and we'll put that. And I think that's the important distinction to know between like the traditional one Russell 1000 value versus like the pure values or the pure growths.
I wanted to ask you about some non-US based ETFs and also fixed income. But before I do, I think this is a good place to just sort of stop and ask, if you were embarking on looking at an index methodology, trying to wrap your arms around it, and looking at the underlying holdings of an ETF and really trying to understand it like you do, like, and assume that, you know, you're talking to a retail investor, a knowledgeable retail investor that's going to read this stuff and understand it, but maybe someone that doesn't have access to Bloomberg and some of the tools that you do, like what would be the way that you would step into understanding that? Like, where would you go? What would you look at? What documents would you try to read? And then, you know, what specifically would you look under the hood of the ETFs to make sure you're sort of, it's aligning? Can you just walk through what your like due diligence process would look like?
Sure. So I'd say one of the first things I do, while it's not the most exciting, but going straight to the source, which would be the index methodology document. So let's say you like this ETF, it tracks an index. Now, all this is public. Like you can go to the website, you can download the methodology. Now, I get it. Sometimes it's like reading through a legal doc. Like there's a lot of stuff in there, right? But I'd say the most important part is like there's a section just called the investment strategy. It just goes through like how the ETF is basically constructed. So obviously knowing that is like where I would start. As you sort of go through it, I'd look at, let's assuming it's equity, the sector exposures, like what are the sector biases that I'm getting? If it is global, what are the different country allocations that I'm getting? But the way I always like to think about things is like, okay, if I'm an investor, I probably already have the S&P 500. I'm just making an assumption here, like I already have the S&P. So if I'm looking at another strategy, like how does it complement that already? So what I mean is I like to look at something called active share, right? Or overlap with like something like the S&P. So if I have the S&P and I have all these stocks in it and I'm buying another ETF that I'm looking at, factor ETF, and it has like no difference in the S&P 500, am I just doubling up on that allocation? Which is fine. Like if that's what you want to do, this, but a lot of things I like to look at is like, how different is this than what I already have, right? Or how different are the weights that I'm already not getting in the S&P 500? So I think active share is a really interesting stat to run alongside like a traditional benchmark. And the other thing is concentration. So what we tend to find is the more concentrated it is, sort of like the more pop you'll get, right? Versus something that has much more diversified or, maybe looks more like the S&P. So in something like factors, right? So I'd want to look at how concentrated is it? How close does it track that factor using some sort of like factor loading screen? And there's a lot of free ones you can get online. Or if you have a Bloomberg, you can run it through that. and the volatility, right? So it all matters. Like if I just want something that's watered down, I would probably go towards a lot of holdings, less volatile, more overlap with the S&P, and then all the way down. So I think that's a, I think just looking in the context of the portfolio is really interesting too, because we can always look at stuff in isolation, but it's like, okay, how does that, am I just paying more than something that just looks like the S&P 500 that I'm already getting, right? So how unique is it? And then a lot of the issuer websites do a really good job of giving you like tools. Like I like iShares website, like they have a factor tool. So if you're interested in that, you can do some factor analysis and whatnot. But I know it's, and one thing that I hope the industry gets a little bit better with is there's not a lot of standardization in the index methodologies, right? Everyone has it a little bit different. It's hard to find sometimes on the website. And unfortunately, like the fact sheets sometimes don't tell you anything. So they'll just say, oh, we track this index, and you have to go to the index website and find out what they do. Hopefully eventually like the industry will get better about putting more information on the fact sheets or on their website. Like, hey, this is how this is how it's built. This is how often it rebalances or whatnot. So a lot of my days just spent going through these different index docs and figuring out, okay, how does this complement in the strategy? Or if I'm trying to choose between the two, like, you know, also in the context of the current market, like, oh, if rates are much higher, like this one might have more of an adverse impact if rates go up or whatnot. So I think it's important to look at it both in the market context and also in your portfolio context.
That's very helpful. Thank you. Because I think some of our audience will want to spend the time to actually do that and dig in deep. You know, many investors don't, or investors that use advisors might not feel the need to do that. But if you're making your own decisions, or even if you're an advisor allocating to ETFs and building, you know, ETF investment strategies and models that way, doing that level of due diligence is important. So, and to your point about, you know, looking for indexes or ETFs that are, you know, helping you diversify outside of maybe the S&P or even maybe the US. Like one of the things I wanted to ask you here is, it's obviously been a pretty terrible relative period for international equities versus US. And so, I mean, we all know that US investors are going to have a natural home bias to their portfolio anyways. But, you know, I think that, you know, most investors in the US are probably very heavy US equity, not very heavy international, because international has underperformed. But when thinking about international indexes and ETFs, I think they'll probably one of the leaders, and there's a number of European, I mean, worldwide global firms, but the MSCI index seem to be some of the more popular ones that, you know, you hear about. So I just wanted to ask, can you just talk to how those are constructed, both in the developed and the emerging markets?
Yeah, sure. And I agree. MSCI is probably the most profound in the international space. So if you could go into other markets, you'll see like MSCI tends to have bigger share than in the US, which is very S&P focused. But in international, it's almost all MSCI and FTSE. You know, FTSE tends to, in their, let's say even in their large cap or their sort of their broader one like EM, tends to be a little bit further down the market cap scope. So you tend to get a little bit more small caps in there. But I'd say the biggest distinction between the two houses, between MSCI and FTSE, is how they categorize the countries, right? And this might not to the layman and be like, oh, I'll just buy the Vanguard Emerging Markets or the MSCI Emerging Markets, which is VWO is Vanguard and the EM, which is the iShares one. Over a 10-year period, VWO has doubled the performance of EEM, which is insane, right? You're like, oh, this is just a emerging markets index. I'll pick one of the cheaper ones, whatnot. And the big difference is there is Korea, right? So like Korea is developed for one in the MSCI index, and it's not in the FTSE one. But Korea is a 12% weight. That's not negligible. That's a pretty decent weight, and that difference actually causes a pretty big performance divergence. So the thing to keep in mind when you're looking at either developed or emerging is the countries that are being upgraded or downgraded, right? Like, does FTSE consider this developed or emerging or and whatnot? And so that for the most part, they're aligned, but Korea is one of the bigger differences. And the other thing is, you know, they started, there's a lot of a China exposure that you'll get in these indexes, and they started adding A shares into it. So they're very, very heavy China exposures. They're both about 25-30% China. But I'd say the biggest thing to keep in mind is how the houses distinguish the countries. And MSCI has a really nice, if you go to their website, you can see how they break down all the countries, developed versus emerging. But I'd say definitely knowing how each of them categorizes countries from developed to emerging market status is really important. And the other thing to look at too, like within the S&P is very global in its own right, right? So you're getting about 30-35% of the revenue from the S&P is coming from global. So if you actually look at that in context, you're like, well, I'm already getting a lot of China exposure. Do I want to go with the index that has less China or more of this and that? So again, I think it just goes back to what I was saying, like how things need to fit into like the portfolio context. But by far the biggest difference is like country classifications between the two different houses.
Yeah, I think those are both very good points. And we've asked this international question to a lot of people that have come on the podcast about what is their take on international investing. And, you know, some of the smartest guys in the business kind of are very different in terms of, and many of them say, like, what the point you just made is that, you know, if you look at like where the revenue from the S&P 500 is derived, you know, a significant portion is coming from, you know, overseas business. So as a U.S. investor, do you really need to be venturing out in those, you know, non-US ETFs, but then you also have obviously the currency hedge and fluctuation too that happens, you know, when you're buying assets in another currency. So that sort of plays a part to some extent in the performance of these things.
Yeah, great point on the currency. International, if you remember, it was like rocking the first half of the year. And I myself got pulled into it too. I was like, is this it? Like, is international going to come back? It didn't end up coming through, but it's, I feel like that's a siren song that we always get pulled into, like, okay, this is finally it. And I think EFO was beating the S&P by like the most ever, like on a rolling basis this year. And that kind of rolled over really quickly. So I don't know when international will come back. It, a lot of places seem cheap there, but you know, to what you had said in the beginning, like on a relative basis, like US has just been the better spot to be. And, you know, maybe again, you're getting that global exposure anyway. So, ends up maybe just flowing back to the S&P, but we'll see.
That sounds like a lot of what value investors have gone through the past 10 years. We're like, is this it? Okay, this is the start of the run. And then, no, we got to go back to square one.
Yeah, no, it tends to flip over, really quickly.
Yeah. What about on the like fixed income side? Like, you know, I know one of the major indices out there is the Bloomberg Aggregate Bond Index. And, you know, there's other, you know, big ETFs that hold a lot of fixed income. Whether it's government bonds or corporates, you know, Vanguard obviously has some very low cost ETFs, but just in general, can you talk, this is a pretty broad question, but, you know, talk about some of those fixed income ETFs and how are they constructed? Maybe if you were to take like the three or four largest ones, like talk about those index methodologies and what is driving those?
Sure. So the biggest one is, you know, disclaimer, I work there, but like the Bloomberg Barclays Aggregate, which is the way it works with these traditional fixed income ones, it's market value weighted, right? So it's actually like the most debt gets the biggest weight, which seems a little counterintuitive, but that's just a lot of times just a liquidity issue. Like they want the largest issuers to be at the top, but the aggregates like kind of your traditional, like would it be like the S&P 500 of bonds? It's a lot of treasuries, MBS agencies in there. And the two biggest bond ETFs, iShares Ag and Vanguard BND, they both track the Bloomberg Barclays. So like it's obviously for an allocation, for just sort of your fixed income allocation, that tends to be the default choice. One that I think is really interesting and growing really fast is the Bloomberg Barclays Universal, which is IUSB is the ticker, the iShares product. But that one has high yield in it, which you're not getting with the Ag. So a lot of times people would buy the Ag and then it would add like a high yield allocation to it. They would buy something like HYG, which is like a really big high yield ETF, or JNK. This is basically IUSB is the ag plus high yield already in that allocation. So that one's getting quite popular just because it's a little bit more of like a broader broader coverage. Because a lot of times when you see these active bond managers, a lot of times the way they're beating the ag is they're just adding high yield on and off, right? And so if you sort of run the stats against the universal, those outperformance rates drop quite a bit when you're looking at an active manager and how they're. So that was sort of this thing. So it's almost like saying you have the S&P, but you don't have a sector in it. It's like, well, let's just get a more comprehensive look into it. So that one's getting pretty popular. And then the other ones are very specific, like the treasury indices, like TLT has been a real big one this year. I think it's like third on the list in flows, or specific high yield ones. And a lot of those it's like high yield, whatnot. It tends to be very liquidity weighted, right? A lot of these products are used by hedge funds and institutions, and they want to be in and out of it. They're using it for they're really getting access into high yield or whatnot. So a lot of it tends to be liquidity weighted, especially in high yield. I think fixed income is really interesting because I think there is a lot of space for index innovation in fixed income. I think people love to focus on equities. I think it's a little bit more exciting. I think it's structurally very different. And indexing and fixed income sort of got skipped over and went straight to active. But I think there's a lot of space in the middle that maybe you don't want to go fully active, or you want something a bit more unique. And that's why I think IUSBs are really interesting. And while it's not maybe like that complicated, it's just adding high yield, I think there's a lot of interesting work to be done in the fixed income space.
Sort of coming up a couple levels from this index discussion, which has been great, and I knew it would be. But I wanted to ask you, so last year, 2022, we obviously saw, the 60-40, it was like the worst, you could poke a lot of holes in what went wrong with a 60-40 stock bond portfolio. Equities down, high inflation, bonds down. So, usually, at least in the last 40 years, it really hasn't worked that way. But last year, it was kind of everything came crashing down. I think the 60-40 had one of its, worst years ever, possibly. And so as a result of that, some of the ETFs that really shined were some of the more innovative ones that are using, and they've been around a couple of years. You had some ETFs using managed future stuff. You had some using other alternatives, methods, trend following might have been incorporated in there. So I'm just wondering, you have a very interesting vantage point of seeing some of these newer innovative ETFs that are almost like carving out this alternative maybe sleeve in a portfolio. So can you just sort of talk to maybe, what you saw last year and how you think that's going to, and what's out there now and how that might influence sort of where we go with some of these more, more unique esoteric ETFs that aren't your traditional stock and bond portfolios?
Yeah, sure. I think you're talking the DBMF, which is a managed futures ETF. Yeah, it was like one of the fastest growers last year. Alternatives did really well. And spilling into this year, I think if you look back, what really changed it was this derivatives rule, right? And so the SEC made it a little bit easier for ETFs to use derivatives in their portfolio. And I tracked it over the last 2 years or so, a third of all the ETFs that have come out have derivatives in their process. They're using derivatives for hedging or for, and the big thing this year is yield, right? Generating yield. We call it yield manufacturing, because now you're getting all these covered call strategies, or you're getting all these products that are specifically trying to squeeze out a lot of yield versus organically through a dividend fund or something like that. So a lot of the strategies on that end are either using some sort of derivative to get some sort of outcome. And the outcome based ones are really interesting too, like buffer ETFs that try to cap a loss and whatnot have been really popular. Again, it's maybe pretty conducive to what the market has been doing. I want to be in the market, but I don't want to be fully in it. I'm okay giving up some upside as long as I don't lose more than 10 or 15%. It goes back to something we were saying, most of the products that are coming out are very, very concentrated. They're very, very unique now. It's not just, no one's launching another US large cap fund. You can't be competitive and raise money there anymore. It's just too tough to go up against the Vanguards and the SPYs of the world. So there's definitely that aspect. And the other thing is, I know this sounds counterintuitive, but a lot of it's been active too. A lot of either they're managing towards an index, but they have some sort of active overlay to it, which has been another pretty interesting trend that we've been seeing. And then the other thing, I think fixed income, I think this is something I'd like to see more, because we're talking about factor investing in equities, value and growth. But if you look at factors in fixed income, looking at, being more selective based on your credit quality or whatnot, it works really well in that asset class, just factor-based investing in fixed income. But that's, the work just hasn't been done there. It sort of got skipped over and they went straight to active. I think as more and more data comes out, maybe more and more research comes out, that could be a really interesting play too. I don't think it probably has quite I think it's a little bit more boring when you talk about it compared to equities. Let's talk about duration time spread in bonds. I think it can get dull very quickly, but I think it's a really interesting spot that hasn't been covered enough. So I'd be looking out for that as well, as in terms of like future product innovation to come more in the fixed income side.
I wonder, like with the managed future strategy, you know, one of the things you see a lot, and you guys have talked about this a lot at Bloomberg, like when a small issue or a success with an ETF, you see the BlackRocks and the Vanguards jumping in, or at least BlackRock maybe more so. I wonder with managed futures how that'll play out. Like, I don't think those big providers have managed futures ETFs, but I wonder if they see a lot of assets coming in, will you see them headed in that space as well?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I guess that's like the ultimate sign that like you've made it, but it's bad because now you have like all this competition. But hopefully, that I get that BlackRock and Man State Street are huge. Fine, we can't deny that. But I think some of the more interesting innovation comes from the smaller providers. So like, I hate to sometimes see that like their innovation gets stifled, because I think that's where some of the cool stuff comes from. I don't know if they're going to touch some of the things. So I think it's an interesting opportunity. Like, I don't think BlackRock's going to get super into derivatives. Vanguard's not going to get into there, right? So I think that opens up some pretty unique opportunities for some of the smaller issuers. And I think they just have to realize that you can't be competing with Vanguard. You have to be complementing Vanguard. And that's where we're sort of seeing like the product launches go. If you want to go head to head with them on a generic sort of plain vanilla fund, good luck, because that's going to be a really tough sell. But if you can find something that can complement that, that's where we're thinking more of the issuers are having a little bit more success. So you have to learn how to live in this like post-Vanguard world that they have your core, most of it. You have to try to get the other piece of it. But the good part about that is like you can probably charge more, right? So a lot of these issuers, they're pretty profitable with only a fraction of the assets. So you could, you know, because you, the investors might have a little bit more to spend on fees because they've saved so much with Vanguard that they have some money they can spend. So I'm willing to go towards like the derivatives-based one or like the factor-based one or whatnot, because I have a little bit of a budget I could use. So I think issuers are starting to adjust to that, that they're trying to live alongside Vanguard rather than trying to deal.
So just in closing, we like to ask our guests a standard closing question, and that is, and you can go anywhere you want with this. You can stay within the ETF lane. You can kind of come up and to talk about whatever lesson, whatever piece of wisdom you'd like to share. But the question is, if you could teach one lesson to the average investor, what would that be and why?
I would say, and not to sound too cliche, obviously know what you're buying, right? You know, do your homework, look through the different methodologies, depending on how bogged down you want to get. The other thing is too, it's already been done for you, but focus on costs, right? Like, cost is probably one of the only things you can control. You know, the markets will fluctuate, you know, value is going to do well at some point, international is going to do well. But I think, you know, focusing on cost is a really important aspect too. And it's just kind of the way I invest too. Like, you know, obviously it's my job to analyze ETFs and come up with these different picks, but you know, as an investor, I tend to be pretty boring. You know, focus on costs, focus on, you know, some of the innovative companies, mostly US focused. But I think obviously trying to focus on costs and diversifying, you know, I think some of the basic, you know, premises of investing, but obviously really knowing what you own. And it's very, and I get it, it's hard. We were saying we have 3,000 ETFs, like that's a lot to look through. Like, it's a big undertaking. Even if we have the tools and we do this every day and we can't keep up with all the new launches. So obviously, you know, being comfortable knowing what you're investing in is definitely probably something I would, you know, make sure that people are doing.
Good stuff, Antonato. So we really appreciate you taking the time with us and our audience today. If people want to learn more about you, I know you're on Twitter. I think you might even produce some original commentary out there. Where can they go to learn more?
Yeah, if Twitter's probably the best way. It's just like @Sarafagus is my last name. If you have a terminal, you can find me on the terminal too. I'm pretty easy. But or LinkedIn, definitely like all the main social media platforms that can be found.
Great. Thank you very much. We really appreciate it. Enjoy the discussion.
Yeah, awesome. This was fun. Thanks for having me on.
This is Justin again. Thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Excess Returns. You can follow Jack on Twitter @practicalquant and follow me on Twitter @JJCarbonell. If you found this discussion interesting and valuable, please subscribe in either iTunes or on YouTube, or leave a review or a comment. We appreciate it.
Justin Carbonell and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Alydia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Alydia Capital.